You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Although the Great Recession officially ended in the summer of 2009, many Americans continue to face financial and economic hardships, some of which were developing long before the financial crisis. For them, work, housing, health care, and other essentials of economic life can be a near-constant source of anxiety. In their book, The Finance Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty, Jonathan Murdock of NYU's Financial Access Initiative and Rachel Schneider of the Center for Financial Services Innovation look into how American families are adapting financially. It's published by Princeton University Press. I'm very pleased it has brought Jonathan Murdock to our show now. Welcome.
Thank you. It's really nice to be here.
Isn't your book based on research you, Rachel Schneider, and others conducted under the title The U.S. Financial Diaries? Can you describe that study?
The Financial Diaries were, in many ways, a very ambitious attempt to try to understand what's going on with American families today. So the idea of the diaries were to find households that would let us into their lives for a full year, 235 families, let us track every single dollar that they earned, they spent, saved, borrowed, shared, really their entire financial lives. And that gave us a window into how American families are making choices, struggling, getting ahead today.
Well, there are about 126 million households in the United States. So how do you wind up with 235? And are they the country is mostly urban these days. Were most of these families in the cities?
The first step was to embrace the fact that we'd never have and never wanted to have a truly nationally representative sample. But we wanted to get to know households that are typical of a lot of experiences that other families are having. And so we focused on families that each had at least one working member. So not the poorest members of their communities, nor the very richest. And we chose sites in Northern California around San Jose, Eastern Mississippi, the Cincinnati area, and here in New York, in Queens and Brooklyn. And our idea was to capture different experiences that sort of typify the struggles of working families.
And did you take race and ethnicity into account? Age?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a really diverse sample. We had immigrants and native-born families. We have white communities, black communities, mixed communities. Here in New York, which is, of course, just a huge mix of different people, the great thing about New York.
Queens especially.
So we have families who immigrated from India, from Bangladesh, from Ecuador, from Colombia. In San Jose, many families immigrating from Mexico. And so we're following both immigrants and native-born families, younger, older, trying to understand how they're moving forward.
So what did you discover? How are Americans faring compared with their peers in other countries with similar economies?
It's really interesting. One of the things which we found is that the way that we usually see America is through snapshots. We have the unemployment rate, right? You mentioned the unemployment rate, debt, GDP growth, a series of sort of snapshot measures of how America's doing. And what we found was that...
Wait, that's the way that economists have been tracking consumer behavior for decades.
Yeah, so
with little snapshots, they don't really do a continuous thing?
Very rarely do surveys actually follow the same households over time. And if they do, usually it's from one year to the next. But we did something radically different. We followed households really week by week during a full year. And that gave a very, very different picture of what households were up against. And one of the key findings was that while we expected households to have relatively stable lives, at least based on the snapshots, that was absolutely untrue. The biggest finding in our data was that households were experiencing high levels of income volatility from month to month. We saw families that had steady jobs, but they did not have steady paychecks.
Didn't a Pew survey find that most Americans would choose stability over a modest increase in wealth?
It's unbelievable, right? So Pew asked households, a national survey, so this was truly nationally representative, if they'd prefer moving a rung up the income ladder or having more financial stability in their life. And Pew let households decide what those things meant. 92% of respondents chose financial stability. And that raises the question, what does that really mean? Where are we as a country today? And have we got the model wrong for thinking about what families are up against?
Is there a threshold where a person has enough wealth to be assured of financial security?
Well, I don't think we're going to shed tears for people earning, you know, $300,000, $500,000. Sure, having more income, having more wealth and assets really make a big difference. But we found that even households that were middle class, maybe earning $60,000, $80,000, $100,000, some of them were really still struggling.
And they told you something similar to what the Pew survey found?
What we found lined up very closely with the Pew survey. In fact, we asked that question, that direct question, of our very own households, and we get similar sorts of answers. It was stability rather than kind of mobility. And mobility has always been the story of the American dream, right? But you know, what we're seeing now is that people are really just trying to get on top of their financial lives and trying to get a sense of control. And that's a very, very different story about America.
Several recent books have looked at the experience of lower and middle class Americans, for example, Evicted by Matthew Desmond and Strangers in Their Own Land by Arlie Hochschild. Did the Great Recession trigger a change of focus by social scientists?
It's interesting. I think what the Great Recession did and what the election did was to open some eyes to changes that have been going on in America really for decades now. And it's not just the Great Recession, but I think new evidence on inequality, the widening inequalities that we see. Since 1970, the top 1%, the top 10% have really increased their income and wealth shares in the U.S. That has really changed how social scientists are thinking about understanding the economy, understanding society. What we are saying, and what we're seeing through the financial diaries, is that it's not just inequality of income and wealth. It's also a real divide in terms of a sense of security. There's a secure America that generally is wealthier and has higher incomes, and an insecure America. And we saw that play out in the election. We see it play out in many ways.
A surprisingly large number of Americans describe themselves as middle class. Could instability be the measure that people are using to judge where they are in the economic ladder?
What we see is a real disconnect between people who feel middle class or feel they should be middle class. For example, we met a family, and the book tells the story of many of the families that we got to know, you know, including data and telling a broader national story. But one of the families we got to know were the Johnsons. Sarah and Sam Johnson live in Cincinnati. By all measures, they are squarely middle class. They are working toward owning their home. They've got cars in their driveway. They have steady jobs. And yet, as we came to see them, we saw that they're just struggling to get ahead of their bills. They're working really hard just to maintain a basic financial life. And they're trying to move forward. Their son graduated as a valedictorian of high school the year we got to know them. But they're also moving backward as bills and uncertainty is weighing them down.
My guest is Jonathan Mordock. He and Rachel Schneider are the authors of a book called The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. There's an ongoing debate over inequality and social mobility. How do financial issues fit in with inequality and wealth or income and with social mobility?
So really there are two dimensions that we see that connect more broadly to other divides. And one is sort of the underlying stability of people's expenses and people's income. What we saw overall on this side of the inequality ledger was across our families, if we look month by month, on average, the households were spending 5 months of the year when their monthly income was either 25% above or 25% below their monthly average, 5 months of the year. And so what we saw was that budgeting went out the window and planning went out the window and a sense of control went out the window. And that's one of the parts then that has to be mapped onto a broader sense of inequality we're seeing in society.
But is this new? In 2007, before the financial crisis, the political scientist Jacob Hacker noted that, quote, instability of families' incomes has risen faster than inequality.
It's not entirely new. What Hacker is pointing to comes from this amazing data set collected by the University of Michigan called the Panel Study of Income Dynamics, which tracks households year by year. And what Hacker was saying was that if you look year by year, the instability of people's incomes has grown remarkably, even faster than inequality. That instability is due to job loss. It's due to major life changes. And that's one big part of the story. What that data says is that the idea of slow but steady incremental upward progress, which kind of is part of the American dream, that's out the window too. That's really been replaced by a lot of uncertainty for families as they move through life from younger ages to older ages. But we're showing something different. We're not looking at the year-to-year changes. We're looking within the year. We're looking at people who have steady jobs, whose family structure is basically the same from beginning to end, and yet they're still facing instability because their paychecks are going up and down. And that's a very, very different story about what's going on in the labor market and what's going on with people's security.
And you write that the diaries show that the power of a cash flow view, there's a power of cash flow view in families' finances. What do you mean by that?
So when we usually look at data, and so Jacob Hacker is a great example. You know, his work looks at income from year to year. What we did instead was to look at people's cash flows. And it's a lot like if you were looking at a business, right? You'd look at how much revenue the business is generating, but you'd also look at their cash flows in and out to see just how healthy they are financially. We did really the same thing for families. We wanted to track their inflows and outflows to see how their cash flows were doing and whether they were on top of them or whether there were serious mismatches of inflows and outflows.
And you discuss one family at several points, Becky and Jeremy Moore, in this regard. What difficulties do they face?
Becky and Jeremy are a really interesting family. They live in Ohio. Jeremy is a long-haul truck mechanic. He fixes those big rigs. He works at a truck stop. And he works on commission fixing those trucks. And I remember going to visit one day, and I was talking to Becky, and she was in a sour mood. And it was just a beautiful day, and I couldn't understand why. And she said, you know, the next paycheck, Jeremy's next paycheck, I know is just going to be lousy. She didn't actually use that word. And
thank you for not using it.
And I said, well, what's going on, Becky? And she said, you know, it's spring, and Jeremy's paychecks are always low. Summer comes, it's incredibly hot. You know, it's hard to walk on the street without burning your feet. And that's when tires of those big trucks blow and Jeremy spends all his day fixing them. Winter comes along, it's freezing. Alternators die and batteries need to be replaced. Jeremy's busy again. So even though Jeremy had a steady job through the entire year we got to know him, his paychecks went up and down remarkably.
But aren't you supposed to do what squirrels do and put the money away during the good times?
Absolutely. And Becky and Jeremy knew that. And they worked hard for a while to try to save. It's just very difficult because the saving process is not slow and steady. When you're in a world of volatility, you're constantly having to rebudget and figure out, you know, new ways to save as your income goes up and down. They found it really hard. In fact, they found it so hard that they ended up closing their saving account. And the way that Becky put resources aside was that she stocked up the freezer with cold cuts and meats. She filled the bathroom cabinets with toothpaste and shampoos. So she saved by literally purchasing physical resources so that when the spring and fall came, they'd have some resources to draw from. Other families had other devices. Everybody knew they had to save, and they were trying to. They just didn't have great mechanisms and very little support from either federal programs or the private sector.
And, of course, it would be different if they were increasing their incomes doubling or tripling them during the good times. It's just only little changes, I assume. Not all that much. You kind of live from paycheck to paycheck when you're at a certain level, whether you're making a little more or a little less. Am I making sense there?
I'm not sure I fully get the question.
I know when I struggled financially, there were, if I made a little more money, then I just bought something a little better to eat that day, that week. And then when things got tougher, I cut back a bit.
The households we met face much bigger swings than that. And when we think about Becky and Jeremy, it was swings of 30% or so in their paychecks. Mm-hmm. So when winter comes, there's a family I got to know in Mississippi, Janice, she's a casino card dealer. And summer's a great time at the casino. She makes a lot of money. Winter comes, the casino clears out. And you know, at that point, Janice is just cutting back on food. It's not moving to a worse kind of food. It's really skimping on groceries. So these are really fundamental struggles for households. And Janice is not poor. That's, I think, the big difference. Janice is really kind of at the lower ends of the middle class.
My guest is Jonathan Murdock of NYU's Financial Access Initiative. He is a co-author with Rachel Schneider of the Center for Financial Services Innovation of The Finance Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. It's published by Princeton University Press. We'll continue our conversation after this. We are back with Jonathan Murdock, who, with Rachel Schneider, has written The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. It's published by Princeton University Press. The economists, got totally confused here. Congressman Jason Chaffetz suggested that low-income Americans prioritize purchasing health care coverage over gadgets like iPhones. Setting aside Chaffetz's ignorance of basic arithmetic, are financially stressed families getting their priorities wrong?
It's a more complicated question than it would seem. The households we met are really, really working hard to deal with the struggles they're seeing. And my sense is that it's not the households that are getting their priorities wrong, but policymakers and, to some extent, you know, the private sector, financial providers, banks. What households know is that when they're facing so much instability, they'd better put resources away to cope with it, just like you were saying. Their priorities have to be on soon, not for later, because if they don't deal with the things coming up in 3 months and 6 months, they're just not going to be able to get to retirement and all those other things that we all hope for. And so their priorities, I think, are where they have to be. But the federal government hasn't really recognized that. And we continually, create subsidies that help people. Oh, the mortgage interest deduction, for example, help people buy homes, or various other retirement subsidies. We're increasingly helping middle class, upper middle class, and richer families with their struggles. We're not putting a priority on the bulk of America and what they're really going through. And partly that's because we're not seeing it. And the book says, hey, let's spend some time with some families, get to know them, tell their stories, and reshape priorities, not for the families, but for federal policy and the private sector.
Well, should people be more financially literate?
Now, it's interesting. The families are financially literate in relevant ways, right? They're savvy. They know what's going on. They may not be able to answer a particular question about compound interest, say, or the effects of inflation. But those questions are largely irrelevant to the families. I think this is another example. We just need to rethink financial literacy. And instead, what matters for lots of families is not those kinds of traditional financial literacy questions, which are really important if you're wealthier and you're thinking about long-term investments. We need to think instead about self-knowledge and how to strategize in a very uncertain situation.
Was Representative Chaffetz tapping into a common view that when poor families do have money coming in, they tend to spend it foolishly?
Well, he certainly was. It's a very common view. And as you mentioned, he misses the arithmetic, right? It's it's not right. We saw families that were really working hard to keep their budgets in line for the most part. Not everybody made perfect choices. Not everybody was a great budgeter. But if I think about it, our 235 families versus kind of typical Americans that are, or even myself, the families were making much tougher choices more responsibly, but they were paying a bigger penalty when things screwed up, when things didn't work out. One of the things I think which is key is we have a view in America about saving that Americans are lousy savers. And if you look at the data, we aren't great savers. Right? If you look at saving at any point in time, American savings rate's pretty low relative to other countries and I think where we aspire to go. But one of the sort of disconnects is that it's easy to move from seeing low savings rates to assuming that Americans then are just spending wildly with abandon, being irresponsible. That's the kind of bias I think that Chaffetz and others have. What we see is something different. We see that people are saving, but they're saving for things that are coming up soon. They're building up their balances, kind of like Becky Moore, who was, you know, buying all that shampoo and stocking up her freezer. Now, people are actually saving in the bank for the most part, but they're drawing it down when they need to and building it back up, drawing it down. So their balances never accumulate. You have savers who don't have long-term savings, and that's the sort of shift in frame that changes the perspective.
So they don't feel the pressure to buy the latest in technology to make their lives a bit more enjoyable?
Like I said, all households made choices which were, you know, some a little bit extravagant, some splurged in various ways. We all do.
And should we judge them for trying to make their lives a little more
comfortable?
I don't
know. Maybe we should. I mean, in the book, our role is just to tell the household stories. But I can't say it was a big theme. I mean, we saw people make some investments and make some choices that probably were extravagant. But, you know, life is not about simply living with a budget that's pared to the bone. I mean, one of the things we saw, actually, that one could question is the households were incredibly generous. They gave to their church or their temple or their mosque. They helped others in ways that my NYU faculty colleagues say, I just don't think they are. And that was very moving, but it also led to lots of questions. Why is that person tithing to the church when they're so strapped financially? And you know, you could see that giving to the church was actually a part of people's identity, what it meant to be in life, why people were working, and you know, why they what drove them to, you know, through the rest of their lives.
Well, they're also building a network when they tithe.
Yeah, also.
My guest is Jonathan Morduch, M-O-R-D-U-C-H. He, with Rachel Schneider, has written The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. It's published by Princeton University Press. Angus Deaton and Anne Cass have described what they call deaths of despair, increased mortality among middle-aged white males. Do you see any connections between your work and theirs?
Anne Case's work with Angus Deaton has been incredibly powerful in showing the high mortality rates of white males in ways that are off trend relative to other countries and relative to other groups. And one of the striking things when you look at the work by Case and Deaton is that the group that's most affected is a group that has completed high school mostly, but not completed college. It's a group that's losing out in the labor market. They're a group that tends to have lower wealth and lower income. And by focusing on that group, I think Case and Deaton are yet another example of how there's an America that's going in one direction and an America that's going in a different direction. For example, the latest inequality data show that between 1980 and 2010, while America on average was moving forward, the bottom half, right, had totally stagnant incomes. And a lot of that group is exactly the Case-Deaton group. And it's also very much our group.
There's been a lot of talk about shifts in the U.S. economy, like the growth of what's called the gig economy, and also automation replacing a lot of jobs that people depended on in the past. Is that something that was reflected in your studies?
It's a huge part of the background of the story, not just our story, but the Case Deaton story and other parts of the story. We call it the Great Job Shift in the book. And the basic story is that starting in the 70s and 80s, you know, jobs have started to change. All right, we all know the story of manufacturing declining. Maybe Donald Trump can do something about that, but it doesn't look very likely. Manufacturing's been declining, and other solid middle-skill jobs, often that are unionized, have been declining. And they've been replaced with jobs that require skill, but pay less and are much less stable. So jobs like home healthcare worker or working in personal security. That fundamental shift in how America works has been getting attention. And the gig economy is part of that. What hasn't been getting attention, and what the Financial Diaries book brings to the surface, is that with that shift in jobs is not just a change in union status or average pay levels, it's also a change in the fundamental stability and predictability of paychecks from month to month.
Here in New York City, one of the biggest issues is housing. How common is uncertainty over housing across the country, especially since the bubble and the financial crisis?
That's a great question, and one that we do not see so clearly in our data. In our 235 households, we certainly have examples of households that were dealing with housing problems.
Well, but would they be more likely to rent because we were dealing with people who were kind of lower income?
There's a mix. In the middle of the country, there are quite a few owners. But one of the housing issues that we saw was not so much about the value of housing, but the quality of housing. Because people are economizing, they're buying lower-cost housing stock, and that's creating additional problems, right? The pipe bursts, the roof needs fixing. And what we saw was households not only struggling with ups and downs in incomes, but also these expenses, in addition to healthcare expenses, that continually hit them and sort of add to the sense of feeling out of control.
And it was pointed out in Evicted that having children, of course, increases costs as well.
Yeah, no, exactly. I just saw a piece by Janelle Marte of the Washington Post saying that before people have kids, they really underestimate the cost of those kids in terms of childcare. And it's very true. It puts a lot of pressure on young families who are the ones who are facing the greatest instability, and they're also facing these pressures all at the same time. And we're, as a country, we need to come together to think about whether we're supporting the right people in the right ways, because we know that for the kids, living in an unstable environment, whether it's incomes going up and down or the structure of that family changing, living in an unstable environment is highly correlated with worse outcomes later in life.
Are there ways in which business or government can make things worse?
I thought you were going to ask whether they can make things better.
Well, I was wondering about, the IRS is going to start using private debt collectors to go after unpaid taxes. Could that affect the kinds of families that you were studying?
Yeah. I mean, these families are squarely vulnerable to those kinds of moves. One of the things I was just discussing with a colleague at NYU is that housing policy is likely to follow the steps of welfare policy, at least it's being discussed, and be time limited and more restrictive in terms of access. So there are certainly government steps that can make things worse for these families. The healthcare policies that are continually being discussed in Washington these days also are going to hurt these families badly.
How are the families in your study affected by the Affordable Care Act?
It's
Is that something they discussed?
Well, we saw lots of health problems. And one of the hardest parts of it, and I think one of the parts that really does need to be rethought in terms of the ACA, is households that are squeezed are going to choose plans with higher deductibles. They're a little cheaper, and they have higher deductibles. And that means while they have health insurance, they're still exposed to a big chunk of the costs of the health care they're getting. they might have a deductible at $500, say. And so we saw households that have insurance but who are still being buffeted by high health costs. And that, I think, is something, you know, if we are going to change health care to create Trump care, maybe that's something we can work on.
The rising cost of pharmaceuticals is a big issue as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something we're now looking into is, you know, we see households, you know, skipping the drugs they're prescribed or cutting them in half, pill cutting, as a response to the kind of pressures they're facing.
Over the long term, what effects could growing uncertainty have?
You know, there are lots of ways to think about that. I mean, I think already we saw some implication with the Trump election, right? Growing uncertainty is tied to a lack of sense of control and a frustration about what, as a country, we're delivering and who we're protecting. So my sense is if we don't pay attention to these issues, we really are at risk as a country of having a nation of frustrated families who are trying to get ahead, who know the rhetoric, who see others moving forward. And it's not just about levels of income. It's really about feeling secure in a more profound way.
Do people talk about race and issues of that sort? Feeling, because we hear again and again about white people who feel that they're being discriminated against even though the statistics might indicate otherwise.
Certainly a lot of the people we met, I mean, they were from various different races. Others, I think, speak about that particular issue in a more profound way. You mentioned Arlie Hochschild's terrific book, Strangers in Their Own Land, where that's a larger theme. But one of the things with race that we do see, for example, Janice, who I mentioned, the casino card dealer in Mississippi, African-American woman, she's in her 50s, and she's dealing with these ups and downs. But her situation is compounded by being an African-American woman who's trying to move forward. She goes to the bank, and the tellers aren't really paying her respect. They're off having side conversations, don't come up and speak to her. She feels like she's not being served well. And, you know, the legacy of discrimination is partly why she doesn't have a college degree, and she's this kind of job, which is a good job, is one of the few good jobs that's available to her.
Jonathan Murdoch of NYU's Financial Access Initiative and Rachel Schneider, who is at the Center for Finances Services Innovation, have co-authored a book called The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. It is published by Princeton University Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you very much.